Well, here in the first 25 minutes of Hour 3 on Issues Etc., we're going to hear some very interesting thoughts from various perspectives dealing with the question of Hurricane Katrina and whether or not it was the wrath of God, the punishment of God on America, on our nation, on the city of New Orleans, on any given sector or group of people in the city of New Orleans or thereabout that southern city. Before we get into that, and some of this is kind of ranges from the bizarre to the mundane, there is a real need for those who are still suffering after Hurricane Katrina and her sister storm that followed shortly afterward and affected many of the same areas and people, Rita. LCMS World Relief proudly underwrites Issues Etc., and their attention, obviously, is turned upon the victims of Katrina and Rita. Yours as well. You can give directly to these victims through LCMS World Relief. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, and you'll see the logo for LCMS World Relief there and a way to give in support of those victims, issuesetc.org. Earlier this week on Scarborough Country, MSNBC's program, there was a very interesting roundtable debate. I'm going to play the audio from you. I want you to listen carefully. A number of people involved in this coming at the same question from all different perspectives. The question being, was Katrina the wrath of God? And then, a little bit after that, here in this first half hour of the third hour of Issues, etc., we're going to be listening to a more recent Hannity and Combs. This, an interview, both of the hosts interview an Alabama state senator who answers the question, was Katrina God's wrath? Was it God's punishment on New Orleans? Affirmatively, he said, yes, it is. And I want to hear your thoughts and comments as well. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. This comes from Scarborough Country, a roundtable debate, was Katrina God's wrath?
You know, the human suffering from Hurricane Katrina, some are saying it could have been part of God's plan. And some are saying that tonight, even that New Orleans may have been targeted because of the city's sinful reputation. So, is the revival part of God's plan also? This is what the Reverend Franklin Graham said last night in Virginia.
This is one wicked city, okay? It's known for Mardi Gras, for Satan worship. It's known for sex perversion. It's known for every type of drugs and alcohol and the orgies and all of these things that go on down there in New Orleans. And there's been a black spiritual cloud over New Orleans for years. They believe God's going to use that storm to bring revival.
So the question tonight is, was God behind the destruction? With me now to debate it, Jennifer Giroux. She's president of Women Influencing the Nation. Kennedy, political commentator and host of Fox Reality Channel's new show, Reality Remix, and William Donahue, president of the Catholic League. Let me start with you, Jennifer. Do you agree with Reverend Graham that this was part of God's plan?
Joe, I don't have any problem with what the Reverend Graham said. I believe that when he talks about New Orleans and a cloud of darkness hanging over an immoral city, he could be referring to any city in the United States. I believe that God will not be mocked. We talked about this just 8.5 months ago with the tsunami. It's a very delicate theological issue, as we talked about then. You know, all of us have a sinful nature, and many innocent people suffer along with those that perhaps were engaged in sinful activity. But let's look at the state of which our country is in. Abortion, contraception, homosexuality, cloning. I mean, it all really comes together in one big picture. Why do you think those like myself and those in my organization that voted for President Bush are outraged that he's saying he doesn't have a litmus test? Abortion is an abomination, an offense, and mocks
God. Well, Jennifer,
God,
let me ask you this about Franklin Graham's statement last night. Just a simple question. Do you associate yourself with those comments that there's a black spiritual cloud hanging over New Orleans and that's why Katrina was sent there to create a revival? Or would you like to disassociate yourself with those comments?
What I will associate myself with, Joe, are the comments that Archbishop Hannon of New Orleans, the archbishop, if you remember, that did the eulogy at JFK's funeral, which just tonight an interview came out from him, who said it was a chastisement of New Orleans and a chastisement of this country. He is a 92-year-old archbishop of New Orleans, a very respected archbishop, who said that we as a nation have got to be accountable for our moral acts as a nation and as individuals.
All right, Kennedy, let me bring you in. What do you think about the Archbishop's comments and Franklin Graham's comments that this terrible tragedy was the cause of God's wrath?
I think Franklin Graham has always appeared to be a pretty reasonable guy. I have a great respect for his father, but after hearing what he had to say, I think that he's insane. I think that he now feels that he is the personal spokesperson for God. And, you know, like I've said in the past, as an Orthodox Christian, I find people who speak on behalf of God, as opposed to those who interpret what they believe to be God's message, I find people who speak on behalf of God to be insane and offensive.
And how does the person claim to be associated with MTV and call themselves an Orthodox Christian?
Oh, you know what, sweetheart? You have an agenda here, and you are trying to steer a conversation about New Orleans and the sin that may happen within the city walls into an abortion discussion. You know, it's
Bill Donahue, let me ask
the far right. It's illogical, Bill, madam.
Let me ask you, Bill Donahue, we hear the Archbishop of New Orleans coming out and associating himself with the remarks of Franklin Graham, saying the city is chastised. Do you agree with that? Do you agree with Franklin Graham?
No, I don't. I know lots of people have gone to Mardi Gras and they've loved it and had a good time and they didn't act in excess. So the idea with, well, you know what bothers me is the certitude that's involved here and the explicitness that we know that God ordained this, that God is vengeful, that this is an act of retribution. It's payback time to get a certain group of people. Why did God choose mostly blacks? Why did God choose New Orleans as opposed to New York City or someplace else? No, look. If one could say this much, remember Abraham Lincoln, back in 1861 at the time of the Civil War, instituted a day of prayer and fasting. And he did it again in 1863, 2 years later, in the middle of the Civil War. He said, we have forgotten about God. We've been caught up in our successes. And we need a kind of a wake-up call, I'm paraphrasing here. And I think he understood that we had this terrible tragedy called the Civil War, and perhaps we should think more about the eternal and the transcendental. And about salvation. I have no problem with that Lincoln-esque type statement. But when people get specific, and they know exactly that this is what God had meant to get a certain class of people because some of them are in excess, and therefore the entire city is going to suffer as a result of a natural disaster, this is not the lexicon of Catholicism.
Jennifer, that's the question
that,
I have. Hey, Jennifer, the question I have is this. I think the part of this New Orleans story that bothered me the most was the fact that you had young 12, 13, 14-month-old babies dying of dehydration on city sidewalks in New Orleans. I don't know about you. I mean, the God that I worship is not a Santa Claus, but the God that I worship does not kill 14-month-old babies in such a heinous way to punish Florida residents that go over and have too much fun on Bourbon Street.
Joe, I agreed with everything my friend Bill Donahue said here. And Bill, I agree with you, and I want to clarify my position. I do not think God targeted New Orleans alone, and I think the Archbishop, who has, by the way, in this interview, been going around to the victims in New Orleans and been getting standing ovations. As a matter of fact, the sheriff asked him to speak to his police officers and explain the association of immoral behavior and what's happening down there, and he's been getting standing ovations. I don't believe God is targeting the city of New Orleans. I believe that this is a wake-up call for all of us, individually and as a nation, to look inward and think, would I be ready to meet God? How is my individual behavior in God's eyes? How do we as a country have to turn back to God? I do not believe God is after innocent children and babies at all, Joe. I agree with you. I believe that the innocent, historically and biblically, and I believe Bill Donahue would agree with this, the good have always suffered with the bad. And that is not for us to understand. I believe God has historically allow disasters and punishments to happen as a form of chastisement. We can go back as far as when God liberated the Jews and allowed Passover to happen and innocent firstborn Egyptian babies to die to allow the Jews out of exile.
Kennedy, let me bring you in here and let you. I'll give you the final word here. You said Franklin Graham. You thought Franklin Graham was insane. How do you think that plays in
on behalf of God is
on behalf of God? Yeah. How do you think that plays? Because we always on this show try to speak to the Middle America that I grew up in. How do you think that plays in Middle America? How do you think that plays among a lot of people in church? Do you think a lot of people in churches may have been offended by those words also?
I think people are offended by that because what happens is when people like Franklin Graham are put under the microscope and, you know, a majority of people think that this is how most Christians feel, it makes Christians seem insane. It makes Christians seem like they are an uneasy people when really I believe that most Christians feel that, you know, God does have a plan. It is mysterious. It isn't something that we can express in words or express personally. And when someone tries to do that, it actually, it removes people from the core of what their faith might be. And, you know, Franklin, you're not speaking for my God. And as a Christian, I'm surprised that you're invoking stories of the Old Testament when the God of the New Testament clearly is not the wrathful, vengeful God that is, you know, throwing hurricanes and floods and locusts around like pies right. at a pie-throwing contest.
All right, where do you begin? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So much there. I'm going to have to just keep writing my thoughts down here. As we move on. Now, we do have some other audio from Hannity and Combs on Fox News from last night, and they talked with an Alabama state senator in answer to the same kind of question, and he says, he has been saying publicly, yeah, this is the wrath of God. Now, we'll get to that audio in just a second. I invite your questions and comments as well. The basic debate on both of these programs was Katrina, the wrath of God, the punishment of God on New Orleans or the nation. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Karen, who calls from her car. Hi, Karen.
Yeah. Todd?
Yes.
Okay. I had a strange noise. I didn't know if you left. I told him, I agree with what Franklin originally said, not with the portion that they just taped. He originally said he believed that God could use that for revival and that he did not believe that God had that it was the wrath of God. I can't remember the exact quote, but on the news they had, in fact, I think it was on KFUO. And so he just, they've kind of misquoted, just half-quoted him.
All right, Karen, thank you very much. Okay, now, Franklin Graham's comments were worth whatever they're worth. He said a number of things, and obviously there in Scarborough Country, they used they were using his comments as a springboard for the basic question, and that is, was this an act of God? You know, the insurance company is going to say Katrina was an act of God. They're not going to make any metaphysical conclusions beyond that. They're just going to say act of God. These things, that's kind of the insurance company's ways of saying these things happen. Now, don't they? Let's talk with John. John, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Pastor Todd, for taking my call. You know, on this issue here, what Jesus was mentioning about where I think the Tower of Siloam fell, and he was addressing the people there about unless you repent something, I'm not sure if I'm getting the words would come upon you. But when we may have the temptation here to look at New Orleans, or the other places here, you know, our concern need not be so much as that is. We need to look at ourselves and, you know, realize, I guess, I don't know if you get what I'm trying to say.
I get exactly what you're trying to say, John. I think it's a very good point. Is this New Orleans repent, or is this Todd Wilkin and John repent? Chuck is up on the line next. Chuck, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
That's exactly right. This is the call for you and me to repent. I was kind of interested in your comment about your insurance company is going to say this is an act of God. And I find that absolutely hilarious. That
what about it's funny?
Well, the fact that your insurance company, who deals with the money of the deal, says it's an act of God, and there are people out there who say this is not an act of God. Well, of course it's an act of God. The question is not whether it's an act of God. The question is, what kind of an act of God is it?
Exactly.
And, you know, is it an act of judgment? Yes. Is it not an act of judgment? Yes. Is it an act of something that happens to us because of the way that the world works because of human sin? Yes. Is it more specific than that? I don't think so. You know, it is a call to all of us to recognize, as Paul says in Romans 8, you know, that the whole creation is subjected to futility in the hope that God has that we will see that this whole thing that we're doing here in this world is not permanent, and that the only thing that is permanent is his grace to us in Christ.
Well put, Chuck. Thank you very much for the call. Jim is calling from his car. Jim, welcome to Issues, Etc. All right, Jim is not on the line after all. Okay, I think we have time to do this, Craig. Let's hear the debate continues on a different program. This Hannity and Combs, someone's sitting in for Sean Hannity, and Alan Combs is there. They're talking to a Alabama state senator. They'll introduce him. And his answer to this question is affirmative. Yes, this was the wrath of God.
In a column he distributed to news outlets this week, our next guest says the damage done by Katrina was God's wrath on a sinful coast. He claims the Gulf Coast has long been known for gambling, sin, and wickedness. Joining us now to explain his comments is Alabama State Senator Hank Irwin. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's my honor to be here.
I find your comments objectionable, but I really want to seriously engage you on them. It seems to me you have a very Old Testament concept of sin, to say the least. And if you look at the New Testament, this issue comes up explicitly. Something terrible happens in Galilee and Jerusalem, and Jesus says explicitly, it's not because these people were any more sinful than anyone else. So it seems to me that your view on this hurricane directly flies in the face of the teachings of Jesus.
Well, you got to read the rest of that chapter, though. That verse also comes right after that saying, but unless you repent, so likewise shall you perish. So he didn't let anybody off because of their sin. Jesus is the same God, and the God of the Old Testament is the same triune God of the New Testament, which is a God that says, if you sin, you have consequences, but I love you, please turn around. And that's what I think we need to have in America, is a re-look at what God is like. And he is a balanced God with judgment along with compassion.
Well, Senator, with all due respect, what you seem to be suggesting is that only people on the Gulf Coast are sinners. And the message of Christianity that I think is most powerful and most obviously true is that we're all sinners.
Well, I agree with that. We're all sinners, but at the same time, there's certain degrees of sin which brings divine judgment all throughout the New Testament, all throughout the Old Testament, when people got to a point of behavior that was sin to a certain degree, God then brought in judgment. And I think we need to ask ourselves, does God still judge anybody today?
So you would agree,
all behavior allowable?
You would agree, Senator, when Al-Qaeda in Iraq says that Hurricane Katrina was the wrath of God to punish America, you agree with that terrorist group? You agree with their estimation?
No, there's a difference. Their motivation is to destroy America. My motivation is to revive America.
Partly through hurricanes, God, that kill
sure.
hundreds of people.
Can God use weather to express a message to America?
Well, Senator, I hope also you're aware that the only sins aren't sex and gambling on the Gulf Coast or anywhere else. There are also sins called pride and presumption. And it seems to me that pretending to know in great detail the intentions and designs of God is exactly that sort of pride and presumption.
Well, I don't think it's pride and presumption. I just say it might be an opportunity to throw down on the table another idea, because everybody's trying to explain the why of why this storm happened. It was a remarkable storm. But I think one thing you need to suggest, if this is a Bible-believing country, is that maybe God did use that to send a message to the folks, not only on the coast, turn around, get right with the Lord, come back to church.
Senator, it's Alan Combs. Thank you for coming on our show tonight. I'm just curious.
Hey, Alan, how are you?
Thank you, sir. Thanks for being with us. I'm just curious, since God is out to get all the sinners, which is why he brought the hurricanes, why didn't they get the French Quarter where most of that sin takes place?
Well, I thought that they did get some flooding
there. No, that was actually the driest part of the city.
Well, I know eventually, but they still got some flooding, I think.
And by the way, why didn't they get
on your channel?
How about Vegas and Atlantic City? That's still standing.
Well, that if I were living in Las Vegas or Atlantic City, I'd probably be sitting up and wondering myself.
Yeah.
God always is sending messages, and
but
I
also,
think it would be interesting for us
like
to consider that
the Bunny
as a
Ranch,
debate.
The Bunny Ranch, you know, where they have legal prostitution, that's standing.
Mm-hmm.
So why do they go after these poor, innocent babies and families who are now in shelters and they're separated and some of them are dead? Mm-hmm. Is God that vengeful?
No, when sin gets into a society, innocent people suffer all throughout history.
That's what God is like?
If sin get into a society, eventually the good people will suffer because of that.
So the,
not from God, but because of the sin that's in that community.
So the real sinners in Vegas
history.
Who are gambling or Atlantic City or the Johns visiting prostitutes in Nevada, they're left alone. And the poorest of the poor and the people and the innocent babies, they're the ones who God wanted to go after.
No, not them. The sin of that community led to the unfortunate suffering of the innocent people. And back, right here in Alabama, we're taking care of those innocent people. I'm involved in a hurricane relief effort right here in Alabama. So the key message is this. Is God a full God that not only is a loving God, but also an accountable God? And should we consider that this hurricane might be a message of
wake up? Well, I can't explain all the innocent people here who were not sinners who got hit here. Also, I'd like to point out, sir, you have the same exact position as Al-Qaeda, who says that, this is hurricanes are to because of the sin of the United States and all the sinners here in this country. So I wonder how it feels to have the same position as our biggest enemy at this moment in history.
Listen, Al-Qaeda can go jump in the lake as far as I care. Their message is to destroy America. My message is, listen, should we re-look at this? Is this indeed an option? Is God sending us a message here? And if so, we need to wake up.
Okay, so much for Hannity and Combs and their answer to the question via the Alabama senator. A couple final thoughts here before we go to this break. And then on the other side of the break, we'll be talking with Jonathan Hill, author of the new book, What Has Christianity Ever Done for Us? He'll join us live from Singapore to talk about the impact of Christianity on civilization. First of all, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org. Go to the search section right over there on the left-hand side. And if you type into the search engine, is God trying to tell us something? You will find an article that I wrote in the aftermath of September 11th. Same questions, exactly same questions being asked after September 11th. Is God trying to tell us something? I wrote a short article there that I think encapsulates my thoughts on this. We cannot let God off the hook. Chuck was right when he called before. This is an act of God. There's no doubt about it. The question is, what kind of an act is it? We cannot let God off the hook. So we don't say, oh, no, this had nothing to do with God. This had nothing to do with human sin. Nor can we say anything more than what God's Word says about these kind of things. And I think one of our previous callers was right in pointing out that when Jesus is reminded of the great tragedy of the Tower of Siloam falling upon so many, he does not say, well, sure, those Siloamites, look at them, look what they were doing. They deserved it. God was sending them a message. No. Jesus turns the message of repentance, which is perpetual, which is continual, which is always there, upon you and me, us. We are the ones who need to hear it. We'll be right back.
For sinners only, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Christians know that God gave us our children so that we could bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. When does that instruction in the Christian faith begin? Well, one Lutheran layman told me, as soon as you bring them home from the hospital. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October is a series of books on the Christian faith aimed at very small children. This series is called Follow and Do. It covers the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, Baptism, Confession, and the Lord's Supper. For more information about the Follow and Do series, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Each book is $6.99. The entire series of six is $33.99. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October, the Follow and Do series for children.
the dinosaur mystery? But is it really?
Answers with Ken Ham, a well-known lecturer on dinosaurs and the Bible. Well, Ken, so many Christians think that the disappearance of the dinosaurs is a huge mystery, but it's not really that puzzling, is it, Ken?
Oh, frankly, I just get tired at times telling people there's no mystery about what happened to the dinosaurs. You see, most people think that what occurred to them must be different to anything that's occurred to other animals. But it's not at all. I live not far from the Cincinnati Zoo. It has one of the world's leading endangered species programs. If I asked the scientists their questions like, why do you have an endangered species program? I think they'd answer something like this. Well, because of man's clearing the land, pollution, lack of food, and so on, lots of species have become extinct and are lost forever. We need the endangered species program to stop this. If you then asked a question like, well, what happened to the dinosaurs? I think the answer would be something like, oh, we don't know. It's a big mystery. Actually, what happened to the dinosaurs is that we didn't start our endangered species programs early enough. The answer's simple and comes from Genesis. Because of sin and the curse and the event of the flood, lots of changes have occurred on this earth, and that's caused many animals, including dinosaurs, to die out. You see, it's not a mystery. It's only a mystery if you believe in millions of years.
Many more of the mysteries surrounding dinosaurs are answered in a booklet by Ken Ham entitled, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? This free booklet is available on our website, AnswersRadio.com.
The niche specialty of LCMS World Relief, along with disasters getting 95% of the dollar given to aid victims, we are determined that that aid be very closely connected with local Christians, local congregations, so the connection between Christ and caring for people is one that remains together. That's who Christ was. He loved people, word and deed. That's what the church does, I'm convinced, on the basis of the New Testament.
That's Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief. For more information, look for the LCMS World Relief logo on our website, issuesetc.org, or call 314-996-1683. LCMS World Relief.
On the next special hour of Jubilation, I'm going to be talking about the subject of divine providence. Do you really believe that the Lord is with you today and will take care of your life? The Bible clearly affirms that He is. Hi, I'm Pastor Mark Hawkinson. Coming up next time, I'll talk about divine providence, and I'll also supply a rich measure of Christ-centered music and Bible-based thoughts as well. So join me, won't you? That's the special hour of Jubilation, coming up Saturday at 4:05 p.m. on AM 850 KFUO.
Friday on Issues, Etc., American Evangelicalism will be the topic. Dr. Mike Horton and Shane Rosenthal, both of the White Horse Inn, will be our guests in the two-hour conversation. Very interesting stuff. We'll be playing some of that Ted Haggard audio from our recent conversation with him and getting the reactions of both Dr. Horton and Shane Rosenthal Friday on Issues, Etc. Then Sunday night on the program, we'll be talking about youth ministry. Pastor Todd Peppercorn of Higher Things Magazine will be our guest. That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. For the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. today, Jonathan Hill is our guest. He joins us live from Singapore, where it's already Thursday. The sun is just coming up there. He's a writer and editor and author of the new book, What Has Christianity Ever Done for Us? Jonathan, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, first of all, the impact of Christianity in the Western world as opposed to the Eastern world, is there a real contrast here if we look at it globally? Can we talk about a greater influence in one rather than the other?
Well, I think we can, to the extent that Christianity has been around for longer in the Western world and had a much greater impact, simply because more people have believed it. But there's a lot of interesting research in the extent to which Christianity permeated the East earlier than we might think. So, for example, especially in the Middle East, as we all know, Christianity began in the Middle East, but it didn't just go away from there in the Middle Ages, as people sometimes imagine. After the Arabian conquests, there were still lots of Christians in In Persia, in modern-day Iraq, for example, they were still there well into the Middle Ages, making quite a big splash. They translated lots of ancient philosophical texts and religious texts and things into Arabic, which is how in medieval times the Muslims had so much. They had works by Aristotle and Galen and people like that, which had been lost to the West. And though that church, the Middle Eastern church, it sent missionaries even further east. They went to India and established a church there in late antiquity, the early Middle Ages, which was quite thriving and made quite an impact in southwest India mostly. And even to China, there was a church in China by the 7th or 8th centuries, which we know so little about, and which, unlike the Indian church, actually died out. But it was there, and we don't really know what it did. Even Indonesia, these missionaries reached. There was a church in Sumatra in the first millennium AD. So Christianity has been a world religion for longer than people might think. It certainly wasn't down to just missionaries in early modern times.
Turning our concern to Western civilization, is there any way to properly understand Western civilization as a whole, apart from Christianity's influence?
Well, it would be a very artificial way if there were, I think. Christianity is just so bound up with Western society. And when I say Western, I mean European, American, South American as well, and North African, if you want to include that as Western. I think because the whole of this area, at least the whole of Europe, was Christian by a relatively early age, and Christianity just became so central to the culture. I mean, for example, in the early Middle Ages, was a time when Europe was being evangelized by many missionaries, and most of Europe didn't have writing at all. And so when missionaries came to the various tribes and countries and things that there were, obviously one of the things they wanted to do is translate the Bible and other Christian works into the local language. But this is often impossible because there was no alphabet at all to write in. So missionaries had to invent their own alphabets. People like Cyril, who evangelized the Russians, for example, is famous for inventing an alphabet to do it in, which was the ancestor of the modern Russian alphabet, which is still called Cyrillic, and the Georgian alphabet and other things like this, the Armenian one as well. They were all invented by missionaries. So the writing itself came through Christianity to an awful lot of countries. It was just so bound up. It's impossible to see where Christianity stops and other culture begins, at least as far as culture goes.
I remember during my seminary training taking a course on the history of, basically the history of thought. You're starting with the ancient philosophers and kind of working your way forward all the way to the modern time. And it seems as though once you get into the Christian era that we usually, you know, mark with that those letters AD, it is either direct influence or, as we get kind of in the 19th century, Christianity becomes the foil off of which many great thinkers are working.
Yes, absolutely, I think so. There's often a sort of tendency in modern philosophy to kind of look down a little on Christian philosophy, I think. Like, for example, Bertrand Russell didn't think much of Thomas Aquinas as a philosopher because he thought Aquinas basically thought he knew all the answers to start with because he was a theologian. And so he only used philosophy as a sort of tool to shore it up with dodgy arguments. But in contrast to the to people like Plato and Aristotle, who are more free thinking, and more recent people who also are more free thinking, but I mean it's a bit unfair to sort of bracket out 1500 years or more of philosophy simply because it was Christian. I think even in areas where it's not explicitly religious, I think Christianity has had a great influence over philosophy. I mean, for example, if you think of the Descartes and the Cartesian stream of philosophy, the emphasis upon what can be known and what can be certain. You can see that going back to Augustine and the desire to stress the fact that we have certainty and we know what is true because we're Christians through Christ. I mean, obviously, it's not an explicitly religious concern in philosophy today, because that still is a big concern. How can we know? How can we be certain about anything? But it has quite a strong Christian element, at least historically.
What do you think about? We have a regular guest here on the program, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, and he often talks about in the postmodern era, the so-called post-Christian era in Western civilization. Even those who are trying to find other ways of constructing thought apart from Christian influence, he says, are still borrowing off of Christian capital. They're still using concepts, sometimes unwittingly, that owe their origins directly to Christian thought and Christian theology.
That's interesting. Gosh, I don't know enough about postmodern religion to comment on that, perhaps.
Well, one of the things he says is, say, postmodernism's rejection of the concept of absolute truth is in a sense, they are they owe Christian thinking for that concept of absolute truth, which they reject, but they owe Christian thinking for it.
I don't know if it's true that postmodernists necessarily do reject the concept of absolute truth. They may reject the notion that we can know absolute truth. I don't know how coherent a position it would be to say there is no absolute truth at all. I mean, for well-known reasons. It's certainly a concept that's been very important to Christianity. I mean, I wouldn't say Christianity invented it. I mean, obviously you can find it in Plato, for example, or Judaism comes to that if you're thinking in religious terms. But certainly the idea that there is truth and it can be known is kind of central to Christian thought throughout history. I mean, it's central to the Middle Ages, particularly the idea that there is an absolute truth and it can be known through different means. So, for example, that the different sciences don't contradict each other. If you include theology as one of the sciences, which the medievals did, the idea that God is the author of everything, and so everything points to God one way or another.
Talk about Christian influence on art and architecture.
Well, there's been a lot of it. I think it's... I think architecture is one of the most interesting areas where there's been great Christian influence, perhaps greater than people realize. People often think that in the Middle Ages there was no technological advance in Europe, that like, everything sort of stopped after the Romans left and before Galileo turned up. But in fact, there was technological advance, but it was mostly in architecture. Which is, I suppose, maybe not quite so spectacular as military advances or things like that. But the great cathedrals of Western Europe, they grew a lot during the Middle Ages. I think new techniques were invented for building them bigger and lighter and more impressive, all of which were well obviously intended to express theological truth. So not simply the magnificence of God, but also the beauty of God. Cathedrals are meant to lead you there, but if you look beyond Western Europe as well, it's quite extraordinary to see some of the things Christians have built. For example, in Ethiopia, the churches of Lalibela, which were built in the Middle Ages there, great rock structures, actually hewn, carved directly out of the rock rather than built with bricks, obviously symbolizing the strength of the church and its ability to survive and withstand whatever assaults there might be. And the Ethiopian church certainly had a lot of assaults in the Middle Ages. And further east than that, you think of the Byzantine Empire and the great churches such as Hagia Sophia with its with its dome. Hagia Sophia was said to be so vast and so beautiful that when people went in, they were just they felt that they were literally in heaven on earth, that heaven had come to earth through the great light space and the incredible marbles and the other decorations, and the great dome itself apparently floating as if by a miracle, supported of course by clever engineering. And some of these ideas went beyond Christianity. So, for example, when the Muslims invaded a lot of the Middle East, they found all these churches with domes, so they just turned them into mosques. And this is one of the reasons why Middle Eastern mosques tend to have domes. Even the Taj Mahal, with its famous dome on the top, goes back to the Byzantine churches, the onion domes of the Kremlin in Russia, of course, is directly based upon the Byzantine domes, but they just kind of extended them up a bit to make them look a bit more impressive.
We're talking with Jonathan Hill. He's a writer and editor and author of the new book, What Has Christianity Ever Done for Us? He joins us live from Singapore. We're talking about the impact of Christianity on civilization. You mentioned here several times the Middle Ages, often characterized in popular thought nowadays as the Dark Ages, as a time of terrible ignorance no advance whatsoever. Society moving backward at a steady pace. But you say that many things flourished during this explicitly Christian era, including education and the preservation of classical thought through Christian education. Tell us about it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, people talk about the Dark Ages, meaning that normally means that the period between the end of the Roman Empire in round about the 5th and 6th centuries and the rise of what you might call the High Middle Ages after about the year 1000. So there was supposed to be this period of about 500 years which was dark, and then things got going a bit better in the Middle Ages after that, but still people popularly don't like the Middle Ages very much. You know, people say things like these views are positively medieval to mean somebody who has terrible, antiquated and irrational views. But of course it wasn't like that at all. And as you say, there was an awful lot of education in the Middle Ages, even in the Dark Ages. When after Rome fell, there wasn't a great deal of learning, obviously, because people were too busy staying alive, I suppose. At least in the West, in the former Eastern Empire, there was still a lot of philosophy and general learning going on. But in the West, there were many attempts to revive learning. The monasteries, as we know, kept all their books, and they kept copying them. And in the 9th century, in fact, they were copying so many that they actually invented a new way of writing in order to copy them more quickly and more clearly. And this was known as Carolingian minuscule, the alphabet they came up with. And it's actually the ancestor of our modern lowercase. Our uppercase letters are Latin. They're Roman. They're the same as what the Romans use. But our lowercase letters come from Carolingian minuscule. So there's quite an impact there. But at the same time that this was happening, this was during the time of Charlemagne, the great Frankish emperor who carved out an enormous kingdom in Western Europe and had himself crowned as the new Roman emperor on Christmas Day, AD 800, which is a nice memorable date. And one of the things he did was he wanted to promote learning and scholarship, which was quite ambitious, given that he couldn't read himself. But he imported all these scholars from around the known world and put them under the leadership of one Alcuin of York, who he imported from England. And Alcuin did his level best, not simply to educate the emperor and his family, but to set up schools throughout his empire. They built schools in all the towns and villages, pretty much, and they were free. It was the first wide-scale free education system in Europe. Alcuin even put signs up on the taverns saying things like, choose. If you come into the tavern, you will have to pay for your drink, but if you go to the school, you can have it for free. I don't know how many people actually responded to that, but it was a worthy effort nevertheless. And so that was kind of the beginnings of what you might call the attempts to re-educate Europe. And it didn't it kind of died out after Charlemagne and his immediate successors died. The empire fragmented, but the same spirit stayed alive. And in the later Middle Ages, it came forth with the development of the universities, which began again. They were, of course, explicitly Christian. They began with the cathedral schools, where teachers began to become associated with particular towns. They would sit in the cathedrals, and people would come to them. And these were very learned men. They weren't simply concerned with theology, with teaching what the Bible taught. They were concerned with more wide issues than that, especially philosophy and philosophy of language and metaphysics and lots of rather obscure things that people aren't very interested in today. But they made a big impact, and law as well. Law developed as a new subject. And so in the later Middle Ages, we find so many teachers and so many scholars in certain places that they kind of achieved a critical mass and turned into universities. University simply being from the word universitas, that the whole lot of scholars in a place. And so Bologna and Paris were the first big ones, Bologna specializing in law and Paris in theology. But of course, they began to spring up all over the place in Oxford and Cambridge and elsewhere. And it's interesting to see how much influence religion had over this, because a parallel thing was happening in sub-Saharan Africa at about the same time or a little later. The great universities of Timbuktu and places like that were also developing as Muslim scholars congregated and shared ideas and found students and so on. It's an interesting parallel development, and it shows how religious learning can kind of snowball and create a whole new culture of learning in itself.
I'm particularly interested in the era of the Protestant Reformation, a movement that was to a certain degree born in the university, especially the Swiss and the German universities, as not only a revolution of theology, but also a revolution in learning and genuine Christian humanism. Talk about that, if you would, Jonathan.
Well, it was at the most basic, it was a revolution in literacy. You know, it was said that a third of all books published in Germany in the 1520s were by Martin Luther, which, I mean, if you've looked at Luther's works on the shelf, you can well believe. But it was the relatively newly invented printing press, of course, allowed the reformers' ideas to spread. But also the reformers' ideas provided grist for the mill, as it were. I mean, there was all this stuff being written by the reformers. People wanted to read it. Of course, one of the central messages of the reformers was the idea that we should all be able to read the Bible. We shouldn't just have the church tell us what's in it. And so people wanted to read. They wanted to read Luther's pamphlets. They wanted to read the Bible itself. They wanted to read the new works of theology that were written by people like Calvin. And so literacy at this time was so low, something like 1 in 20 in the population at large could actually read, rising to only 1 in 3 in the big cities. But now there was great impetus for people to learn to read, and so the Protestant Reformation really encouraged that. I mean, it wasn't until perhaps the 19th century that really large numbers of people could read, but that was the culmination of a movement that went back to the 16th. But there was more to it than that, of course. The reformers founded schools of their own. So, for example, Calvin founded the Academy in Geneva, which he intended to be a premier educational establishment that would help to spread the seeds of the Reformation throughout Europe as students came to it from all kinds of countries, studied there, and then went home again. And, of course, that worked. People like John Knox, for example, the reformer of Scotland, was a student at the Academy who went back home and took its ideals there. It sparked not simply within the Protestants themselves, within the Catholic Church as well. So, for example, the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus was founded at about the same time that the early Reformation was taking place, not deliberately as a response to it, but of course it was used as a response to it in the years that followed. And the Jesuits are famous for their schools. Ignatius Loyola started educational establishments for the Jesuits themselves. But later he realized what a good idea it would be if he allowed everyone to go to these schools and they could be trained by the Jesuits and spread their ideals just as the Protestants were doing. And the Jesuit schools were free, just like those schools of Charlemagne so many centuries before. And again, they were really good. People went to them because they taught everything. They didn't just give you a course in Catholic theology. They taught you all the latest science and humanities and the rest. Of course, Jesuits were at the absolute forefront of scientific research in the 17th and 18th centuries. Jesuits traveled around the world watching eclipses or having themselves lowered into volcanoes to see what was going on and strange things like that. And so there really was an explosion in learning at this time. And the I suppose the culmination of this was our modern belief in meritocracy and people are entitled to a free education, and those who are good at learning should be the ones who go on and take it to higher levels. We can see this at, for example, the Lutheran University of Halle, which August Frank was the big Lutheran theologian there, and he oversaw Halle, and he basically transformed it into an integrated education system. The schools of Halle were... he had students from the university teach there, and the best pupils at the schools were picked to go to the university, and it was about ability and merit, not about wealth. It was basically the origins of modern Western education as we know it.
Jonathan Hill is a writer and editor. He's author of the new book, What Has Christianity Ever Done for Us? He joined us live from Singapore. Jonathan, our conversation could continue, but our time is up. Thank you very much for being our guest.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Talking about the impact of Christianity on civilization. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, very interesting conversation on bringing your faith to work. Dr. Norm Geisler of Southern Evangelical Seminary will be our guest, talking a bit about Christian vocation in that line. And we'll also talk about the eclipse of Christian Europe, dovetailing with what we've just been discussing with Jonathan Hill. Bill Murchison of Baylor University will be our guest. Friday on the program, American Evangelicalism is the subject. Our guests for that two-hour conversation, Dr. Mike Horton and Shane Rosenthal of the White Horse Inn. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of you, please give this some serious consideration. Coming up, the week of Reformation this year, November the 5th, in fact, we're going to hold our 10th anniversary banquet. It'll be 10 years then that the nationally syndicated edition, the Sunday night edition of Issues, Etc., has been on the air from four affiliates to almost 100 nationwide. Now we have room for 200 at this banquet. We've got 80 reserved already. That means there's a room for 120 more at this November 5th evening banquet in celebration of 10 years of Issues, Etc. For more information, contact Jenny Williams at 314-505-7836, 314-505-7836. You can also email her at jennyw@kfuo.org. Lots of Issues, Etc. guests will be there. Larry Rast will be our keynote speaker, also Matt Harrison, Dr. Norman Nagel, Dr. Reed Lessing, Dr. David Adams, Tom Baker, Dr. Lou Brighton, Dr. Martin Nolan, so many more that night, November the 5th, for our 10th anniversary banquet of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.